This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 2nd of October, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we head to Istanbul to hear how the city's empty factory buildings are once again humming with industry.
People want this factory to live. It doesn't matter what it does, as long as it works and it creates energy and as long as it creates employment for the people.
From Istanbul to Ireland, we find out how the country's time-honoured craft tradition has its sights set on the world stage.
People won't buy Irish just because it's made in Ireland. It's got to offer more than that. And I think heritage is really important there.
And over in New York, we drop in on retail hotspot Five Story to talk menswear.
Most of the stuff has some unique detail that someone's gonna be like, oh wow, what is that? So it's important to tell them the stories behind the brands because that's gonna get them into it even more, and it's also what's gonna have them sharing it with their friends.
More on that shortly. Elsewhere, we don our deck shoes for the Monaco Boat Show, and we'll talk design and business with Heather Fraser from Rotmans. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D. Stay tuned. We start this week's show on the shores of the Bosphorus. Istanbul is famed for its rich hodgepodge of a history that has left the city's architectural landscape nothing if not diverse. But while much attention is given to the minarets and palaces, more recent relics from Istanbul's industrial past lie hidden. Following a boom in the 1960s and 70s, major industrial operations were moved to the larger, cheaper land in the suburbs. Now, many factories, power plants and warehouses sit abandoned, raising the question of what should be done with all these empty buildings. A growing crowd of owners and architects are tackling this question. Our reporter, Ashley Cleek, went along to join in the discussion.
Albert Avashvili stands on the roof of his grandfather's factory, looking out across the Golden Horn.
This mosque right in front of us is the minaret you see is from the years 1453. And there's also a Greek Orthodox church, which you see the dome right here.
All of Istanbul stretches out below him. It's a scenic spot. And next to the water, it's an ideal place for a factory. Albert's grandfather thought so too, and opened the Haskoy Yarn Spinning Factory in 1952. What they called greasy wool would come in on boats, and out of the factory would come spools of dyed yarn to be sold all over Istanbul. Albert was only a kid. He was born in 1957 and started working at the factory as a teenager. The factory itself is huge, 9 buildings, all different sizes. Some are 3 floors tall to fit giant machines that would press the wool. Some are long and thin. Now Albert is the owner of his family's factory. He kept the machine spinning until 2010. Production stopped, but the building was still there. Now, Albert happens to be good friends with a couple, a husband and wife, who also happen to be architects in Istanbul. Murat and Merkan Tabanoglu.
Okay, I'm Merkan Gürsel Tabanoglu. I'm an architect. I'm one of the partners of this company.
In 2004, their architectural firm Tabanoglu created the Istanbul Modern, Turkey's first modern art museum, from an abandoned storage space on the banks of the Bosphorus. The most important thing about industrial spaces, Merkan says, is that they often have huge open rooms without columns, which works great for art.
For a museum spaces, the dimensions are very important. This building was ready to be something else, you know? And it was a chance. And for that, we like so much old, you know, industrial building because, you know, they are ready to be everything, you know? It's like a zero-age baby.
So when Albert was rethinking what to do with the Haskoy factory, he talked to Merkan and Murat. They were helping to plan the 12th Istanbul Biennale, a contemporary art festival in Istanbul. And they thought, why not hold an event at the factory? Albert walks down the stairs into a huge open room. These used to be the spinning rooms, he explains, where wool was twisted into yarn.
There were about 9 spinning machines here. You can still see the footprints of the machines here on the floor, which was not removed.
Why keep the footprints?
Why not? I mean, it's anything which is related to history, we try to keep it as much as we can. At least we don't try to remove it.
The rooms are white, with high removable walls. We walk through an even larger room with a few spinning machines still in place. Albert says they like to keep the machines around to make people remember this used to be a factory.
And this is a famous corridor.
The corridor is more like a tunnel, 80 meters long and dark, with sunlight coming through the end.
We don't allow anyone, you know, don't allow them to paint on the walls. Keep the structure as it is.
The passage was red, for example. And we didn't touch, you know, the color of this passage also. This is the character of the building, you know. You don't lose it. It was dirty, you know, the machines was dirty too, because they didn't use for years and years, you know. And you should see all the, you know, layers of the years like that.
I think people, because it's a long tunnel that they have to walk about 230 meters, so then they start thinking, I think, that's what makes them feel differently.
The tunnel opens into a cave of space. It used to be full of machines that would clean and weave the wool into a web. Now they throw dinners here, and in the corner, metal scaffolding has been turned into a DJ booth.
To read the story, to see the story, it's really important for us. Because architecture is not only to make something, to make some building, some urbanistic, you know, planning, but to live, you know, the history, you know. Because you are writing a story when you are making your buildings. Because after you will say, okay, it was a factory and now we are using for an exhibition or for an event. No, but in this, between these two functions, it was the years. Dust and everything, you are reading, you know, this history. And for that, we didn't want to kill it. We wanted to, you know, keep it.
This room is in the process of being converted into an exhibition space. But Albert says he keeps the old signs up to remember that this was where thousands of people worked.
Never forget that the only one who has the right is the one who works.
And that was the point, Merkan says, to keep the factory as a reminder, but to fill it with people. On the opening night of the first exhibition, the neighborhood was alive with young and old, former workers and gallery goers.
Everybody leave their small shops open until midnight. All the collectors, all the, you know, the high society of Istanbul came, and at the same time, all the people from the region with their scarf on their, you know, head, with their granddaughters. They wanted to share, you know, the space with everybody. And this kind of touch are the good viruses. They are starting to change, you know, the environment, which is very important. And for that kind of region is more important than anything.
For Albert, it was important that the building, whether it was a factory or a space for art and exhibition, still continue to be part of the neighborhood.
We have more than 25,000 people who worked in the site. And we still today, when we go out on the street or go into a taxi, we still come across a lot of people who worked there somehow. And people want this factory to live. It doesn't matter what it does, as long as it works and it creates energy and as long as it creates employment for the people.
There are dozens of former industrial spaces in Istanbul. Down the Golden Horn from Haskoy, an old cigar factory is now the main building of Qatar Has University. And in a city like Istanbul, with thousands of years of history crowded into narrow streets, Merkan believes that old buildings have to be reused.
Because now we are talking about the sustainability, because the world is face to face with a very important economical situation. And in this situation, of course, it's always better to reuse the building, which is existing. And at the same time, it's adding another value to the cities, because it's not knock it down everything in one day and to make the proper, you know, clean-cut buildings. This is not the reality. In the cities like Istanbul, it's always better to keep, you know, the history, because around this old building, there are many other old things together, old lifestyles, everything. And putting a new functions, you address, you know, one idea. And after, the other is following the first idea. The first step is very important for that kind of transformation.
Throughout the neighborhood of Haskoy, the transformation is visible. There are galleries and studios, a museum, and at the center is the Haskoy Yarn Factory.
That was our reporter Ashley Cleek there, and from Istanbul we're off now to New York. Opened at the end of April, Five Story is a new type of retail environment for the city's traditional Upper East Side. Situated in a townhouse near the luxury boutiques of Madison Avenue, Five Story has injected a little more excitement into the quiet neighbourhood. The intimate space houses women's clothing and shoes, jewellery, children's clothes, as well as select homeware, and the newest addition to Five Story, a men's boutique, which brings brands like Visvim, Tensi and Kitsune to uptown customers. With little experience of menswear, Five Story's owner, Claire Distenfeld, brought Union Los Angeles's Chris Gibbs on board to oversee the menswear. Aisha Spears met with the duo and started off by asking Claire what made her choose Chris as a partner for the men's boutique.
I knew I needed the men's to really position itself parallel to it. The idea of something unique and idea of something special, but grounded in elegant, timeless luxury. Meeting Chris organically, he opened my eyes to these Japanese brands that kind of really carry out that mission statement as well. And I think that's kind of what got us really excited about working together and kind of catapulted us into this men's department.
What was your initial reaction when you knew you were going to do this here at Five Story?
I was really excited. I had met Claire and we had lunch and it was very quick. But I immediately picked up that she had the same kind of passion, which you need, because this stuff needs to be sold, because people aren't going to get it at first, and the same kind of attention to detail. So I was really excited about it. And then my second thought was like, wow, there are geographical and social constraints with Union that I won't have. So I can buy anything. I can buy for four seasons, because in LA, we don't really need jackets. So I was really excited, like, here's my, you know, like a blank palette. I can do whatever I want. So that's between our sensibilities being very similar and the fact that I can do something that isn't being done in New York, and so many people have asked me to do it in New York and do it with a partner that I, you know, really got along with. So that was kind of the first thing that got my first couple thoughts. As far as the differences go, this is a little bit more conservative. My store's been around for, you know, depending on how you want to measure it, but over 20 years, or at least it's been mine for five. So we have a long standing relationship with good customers who appreciate what we do. And whereas this is going to be new no matter how you cut it. So we had to be a little bit more conservative with the buy to start off with. But for the most part, I got a little nervous. I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, you know. And then I just realized, look, Claire's come to me, and I'm going to give her what I have access to and what I'm good at. So for the most part, it's very similar. So for someone who's maybe from LA or very familiar with our store, they might walk in here and be like, yeah, I've seen this before. But for the most part, it's pretty unique, I think.
Who did you decide would be a good fit here?
Probably the easiest. And the first one was Visvim. It's my personal favorite brand. I've loved it since day one. And I feel that because I'm personally passionate about it, it's helped sell it here, because it's definitely something that's pretty foreign. When I say here, I mean in America in general. And I thought, oh, wow, for a store that's on the Upper East Side, it's going to be catering to a very discerning customer. They're going to want quality, all the things that Visvim has. But it's classic enough, you know, as I think I told you before, it walks the fine line between fashion, men's contemporary, something that's fun but still wearable. So Visvim was the first one and the easiest one that I thought of, and thankfully they were down to be here and were excited to be a part of it. Another brand that I thought would have been really good here, and it was the whole Four Seasons thing that got me excited, was Tensi, which is that Italian brand. Beautifully tailored jacket, really cool styles, because they're taking, you know, military silhouettes, and then an amazing fabric, which is that knit kind of nylon. Those were two that to me were easy no-brainers, you know.
And who is the customer? I mean, and for both of you, I mean, I think that you're educating them is a word that you used earlier. So it's, you know, here's a shirt which you'll feel comfortable in, and here's a slightly more out-of-the-box one from Visvim, which you'll feel just as comfortable in. How do you do that in a place like the Upper East Side?
I think the whole education is really brought in by Chris, the idea of, you know, I never knew 10C's fabrics were influenced by the top of a convertible car. I think that's amazing. So you think about that, and then you think about your customer.
Most of those guys, it's like to have a story behind it. And that gets them into it. And they'll be sitting with another guy, one of their friends or whatever, or a woman, and someone will inevitably probably ask them about this stuff, because it's most of the stuff has some unique detail that someone's going to be like, oh, wow, what is that? Or if you feel the 10C jacket, you're like, wow, that's, what is that? So they like to be able to retell that story. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of it. So as I've been telling Claire and the staff here, like, it's important to tell them the stories behind the brands, because that's going to get them into it even more. And it's also what's going to have them sharing it with their friends who ask about it.
That was our Aisha Spears in New York with five stories, Claire Distenfeld and Chris Gibbs there. We'll be talking basket weaving in Ireland next, but first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. Ireland has a rich heritage of craft, from Aran jumpers and basket weaving to lace making and Donegal tweed. But its relationship with craft and its makers has been less than straightforward over the past two decades. An economic boom, followed by a crippling recession, has prompted an overhaul in how Ireland values its craft industry, both emotionally and economically. Hazel Pfeiffer visited an exhibition recently in London, intent on putting Irish craft back on the world stage.
Standing in a small warehouse space in Shoreditch during London Design Week, I'm surrounded by a selection of beautiful objects, all of them made in Ireland. Sofas in bespoke Donegal tweed, cushions made from Irish linen, a huge hand-woven willow lampshade over a smooth lacquered table, and wide shelves covered in colourful ceramics and hand-blown glass. Thankfully, there's not a shamrock in sight. The curator, Jonathan Legg, has chosen carefully, intent on displaying what a small country with a long craft history has to offer.
Ireland had the first state-run design agency, Kilkenny Design, and it was set up by the state, and it was when Ireland was a young state, and that agency worked with a group of Scandinavian professors who came over from Sweden and Denmark and Finland and wrote a whole report about the Irish industries and Irish craft, and that was the basis for the founding of Kilkenny Design. And it grew from a small design team doing the graphics for our national postal service and our national telephone service into producing and designing work for Conran shops when they were starting out. Yeah, Ireland was leading the way in the 60s and 70s, and had a store in Mayfair, and it opened a store in New York, and had an amazing restaurant. It was doing all the things that people are looking for now, and I guess the 80s was bad for that type of industry, and it fell away.
Despite this promising start, the Irish craft industry remained in limbo for a few more decades.
Yeah, I think the value wasn't being recognised, and maybe there might have been also a thing within the Irish psyche that we needed to evolve faster and step away from our own indigenous crafts because it represented a time and a place that maybe a lot of people didn't want to be part of anymore. but it represented a very solid space and a more comforting space, so I think now it feels more relevant again. The place and the land is in all these pieces, and there's a value in that.
Connecting what's come before with what lies ahead is a challenge for any industry with a strong tradition. Now, a new generation of Irish designers are bringing elements of Irish craft to their work. London-based Irish designer Claireann O'Brien makes sculptural furniture with innovative use of knitted fabric.
I'm very aware of my Irishness. I think that's probably because I, while living abroad, I talk about Ireland a lot and romanticise it a lot. So I do look at Irish traditional culture and crafts, especially with this new collection. It's called Ullin, which is Irish for wool. And kind of looking at a more traditional Ireland, like fishing villages and knitting and iron knitting, basket making, all those sort of things has inspired the new collection. And I think the colours, like the two new pieces here, are a mustard and a grey, which would be kind of inspired by the Irish landscape.
Brian McGee is head of market development for the Crafts Council of Ireland. It's the first time the Crafts Council has exhibited at London Design Week, and they are keen to promote Irish craft on an international stage.
Well, this exhibition tries to tell a story about the connection between where something is made, the place where it's made, the person who's imagined, designed and made the object, and then how it gets used and how people live with it.
So the Crafts Council has done a big push in recent years to promote Irish craft. Was Irish craft in need of a makeover?
Oh, look, absolutely. Overly obsessed with tradition, overly obsessed with just making for making's sake, not thinking about design and innovation. Really, it's the colleges, it's the graduates themselves, the young people like Jonathan and people coming through the education system and discovering that making is important. People won't buy Irish just because it's made in Ireland. It's got to offer more than that. And I think heritage is really important there. So, textiles, glass, jewellery is another area where there's a long heritage, thousands of years of heritage in these crafts. And that's what we need to focus on.
While Ireland continues to struggle with the recession, a return to craft could only be beneficial to the economy.
Craft businesses are small, so you have this whole web of small businesses, and you can have that across the country. But there's been studies done about how the economics of many small-scale businesses is far stronger than the economics of a few larger businesses, because one or two go, but the web stays strong and other people fill that space. Craft offers that business model, so I think that's strong for the economy. Because we never had a manufacturing industry as such, so craft is always what we had. It was always small-scale production, and that feels more relevant today than ever before because of how the manufacturing industry is going around the world and how more manufacturing is coming back to Europe, but in a smaller scale and a more artisan scale, and Ireland can do that and do it really well.
It's a traditional Irish basket, which is a historical basket called SCOIB, and it's pronounced skib.
Nearby in SCP, traditional Irish basket weaver Kathleen McCormick is sitting in the window, surrounded by stacks of fragrant homegrown willow. Busy weaving baskets while chatting to fascinated onlookers, she is part of a pop-up shop for Makers and Brothers, Jonathan Legg's online retail store which champions beautiful and useful Irish craft. Kathleen has seen a change in attitude to Irish craft over the years.
I think that the people who were doing it didn't actually value themselves. They saw there wasn't a validity to what they were doing. Thomas Hardy, in one of his books, talks about a man whose daughter who's getting married, and she's marrying a rattle man. And rattle is the stamp that they put on sheep. But this farmer was saying he was so lucky because his daughter was marrying a rattle man, at least she wasn't marrying a basket maker. I mean, they were so low on the social scale. Whereas now, if you're a basket maker, you have a skill, you have a talent.
With basket weaving as well, the end product is so functional. I mean, these baskets are so usable in everyday life and would last for so long.
Yes, that is true. I think it's one of the very emotive products. yes, glass is beautiful, but it's still a glass or a jug, whereas a basket somehow, it represents so much more. It's growing and harvesting and making and planning and, you know, it's emotive.
And so many people have memories of baskets as well.
I meet a lot of people who say to me, my grandmother or my grandfather was a basket maker. And I think that's wonderful that they remember that, that it not only stuck in their mind, but they're proud of it. You know, no longer is it second best to a rattle man.
Back at the exhibition, looking at the array of products, each with its own unique story, I asked Jonathan what he thinks distinguishes Irish craft.
The Irish are kind of a poetic bunch. I think that comes through. I mean, poetry of our nature and our culture and the weather, because that affects the material and the quality of the wood we can work with. And yeah, I think the weather affects the people. So maybe it's the weather.
So rain distinguishes Irish craft.
Yeah, you could say that.
Well, we've got some lovely results from quite a lot of rainfall. For Monocle in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
And sticking with the Irish theme, here's the beautiful Roisin Murphy with Overpowered. That was Roisin Murphy with Overpowered there. You're listening to Section D. Now the summer sailing season may be behind us, but the yacht industry is in full swing, selling models for next year already. In recent weeks, marinas in Cannes and Monaco have both put on their annual yacht shows. And this weekend, Genoa will kick off its annual exhibit of boats, big and small. One brand that has been making waves in the industry is Wally. The eye-catching shapes of its sailing and motor yachts stand out in a sea of carbon copy designs. We sent Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to Monaco to visit Wally founder and president Luca Bassani, who welcomed him aboard the company's latest model, the Wally Ace, to talk design.
In our mind, boats should be very simple, very clean. Many times people say uncluttered. We love uncluttered decks, not only because they are very nice to see, but also because they are much more comfortable. If you talk about sailboats, on an uncluttered deck you don't have all the dangers for for your feet, for walking around. So everything starts from a functional point of view in Wally.
Some people might say the silhouette of a Wally is a bit aggressive. How would you respond to that?
I would respond that probably Wallys are very masculine. So for this reason, having these boats so masculine, we achieved to probably attract a big part of the feminine world that many years ago were not interested at all in boats. But looking at the Wally, that at the same time were masculine, but offering also comfort that any other boat were not offering to them. I mean, big areas for sun taking, or big areas bigger galleys or thing. Any kind of feature that could be interesting for a woman. And I think Wally was the first really shipyard and yacht designer bringing that. Before Wally, I could tell you, no woman was looking at a sailboat working on a dock.
Now, interior design has become very important on motor yachts today, for example. In some ways, they resemble almost apartments, lofts in Manhattan. What is your take on that?
I believe that lately, the interior design has been overvalued. We've been probably one of the first brand introducing a new interior designing, more contemporary style, while any other shipyard at that time, 15 years ago, they were still building interiors like mountain chalet or English castles or things like that. But today, I think this aspect is really overvalued, and many boats are judged by the client only by the interior style and not by the real quality of the construction as the real quality of the hydrodynamic, for example. So they're ready to buy boats that are probably very nice inside for them, but they're very bad through the waves in the ocean.
Explain to me the boat we're on now, the Wally Ace, the background, how it was developed, the reasoning behind it.
Wally Ace is the result of the, let's say, the trend of the market, of the industry in the last years after the crisis. In our opinion, less and less clients for powerboats wanted to have very fast powerboats, powerful, and polluting very much with a lot of consumption. So a lot of these clients are now looking for more sustainable, more reasonable, smarter kind of boats. That's why we decided to design and conceive a displacement boat. So a boat that cannot plane but can go 12 knots cruising, but also cruising during the night. So when you wake up in the morning, you are in a new bay, in a new island, in a new location, with the maximum comfort. For example, on board the Wally Ace here, in the living space, we have 360 degrees of view. While normally on a boat of this type, and not only of this size, but even bigger, you have a much reduced view. This is another innovation of this boat, like, for example, the master cabin on the really on the stern of the boat. And the stern of the boat is glass, so it's visually open to the sea. And you can also open these glasses because you have two big doors. And actually from your bed, you can jump into the sea. So you have your own beach and you can jump into the sea, you sleep there, you have the fresh air from the sea. I mean, all these kind of features are really absolutely new on the Wally Ace. No other competitor has something like this.
That was Luca Bassani, founder of Wally, talking to Ivan Carvalho at the Monaco Boat Show recently. Now, just as form and function is a fundamental design equation, more and more the design equals good business school of thought is being adopted in the boardroom. Rotman's Design Works Strategy Innovation Lab in Toronto pioneers study in this field. Monocle's Gillian DeBias sat down with its director, Heather Fraser, who recently penned a book titled Design Works: How to Tackle Your Toughest Innovation Challenges Through Business Design. Gillian started by asking her about the mission of her department.
It is a center within the Rotman School of Management dedicated to understanding how can design shape the way we think about and go about building our businesses. We work with executives all over the world, and we work, of course, with our MBA students. We're focused on both education as well as doing research to try to advance that discipline.
When it comes to business thinking, surely, is it two different parts of the brain? Do you have a finance business brain, and do designers and creatives have another side to the brain? And can that ever be taught?
I think that everybody has a whole brain. So that's premise number one, is that everybody has a whole brain. The trick is how you access that capacity and really are a well-rounded thinker. People prefer to do certain types of thinking and certain types of activities. Some people love to design, and some people love to analyze. But everybody is capable of doing both if they so choose. And so as part of the education program and the MBA program at Rotman, what we're aiming to do is to help the students access different kinds of thinking so they can be more well-rounded in their thinking, because business is really a very creative act. And why shouldn't you think like a designer and behave like a designer when you're trying to build a new business? Many great entrepreneurs do kind of intuitively think like designers. So I don't think it's a matter of some people have one half and some people have the other half that's more active. I think that's a matter of bringing your whole brain to play when you're trying to solve really complex challenges and create new things in the world.
What are some of the design ideas that you write about in your book that translate well and can really power up business?
So traditionally in business, there's a focus on analytics, there's a focus on data, about minimizing risk, about being really good at what you do. But there's another side, which is thinking about the more intuitive side, using your imagination, generating new ideas. You could say it's the creative dimension. And also thinking about, instead of being perfect at what we do, why don't we just try something and experiment? And then based on that experiment, we're going to learn something. If it doesn't work, we'll just move it to the next level. And so thinking of a business as in a sense, a prototype, and continuing to push out, try new things, and advance your offering to the marketplace. So those are designerly things. And great entrepreneurs do that quite naturally. And in fact, in my book, I talked to Richard Branson and Izzy Sharp and a number of others. They did this in their business. They thought about the human aspect. They pushed out. They experimented. They expanded from there. And that's what has been, in many cases, missing in business in recent years. Of too much focus on not taking any risk and gathering lots of analytics, but really never really advancing things in a meaningful way.
What's interesting in your book, as well as the theory and the example and the instructions, there are lots of great interviews and case studies. And I wonder if perhaps we can focus on one of the case studies or an example to give an idea of what you're talking about. Maybe Nespresso, you can talk a little bit about Nespresso.
Yes, now Nespresso is a perfect example of business design. And they hadn't read the book 20 years ago because it hadn't been written. But as an organization, they set out to take this big, rather clunky institutional machine that had this super cool technology with these little capsules and say, what if we took that and expanded that into not only the business world, but also into homes? And in order to do that, we need to have a better design. We can't sell what we've got here, so they hired the best designers in the world. And over the course of what was really almost 20 years, they continued to switch it up on an ongoing path of innovation, but they had their sights set on having a unique coffee system. They had a different kind of relationship with the consumer where they weren't selling through a grocery store like the mothership Nestle does. They had a different kind of relationship. They had a different relationship with the growers of their beans. They opened a retail store. So everything about their business was a complete reconfiguration of how to allow people to have this exquisite espresso experience in their home.
When you look over the horizon and cast out, what countries do you think are really good at mixing sort of business and creative thinking and using design to grow and to be successful?
Oh, every country's got their own mix. I think the common element in all countries around the world right now is that they are all trying to harness the talents of their people more fully and to find ways to innovate to move their economies ahead. So if you start with that as the premise, then everybody is motivated to try to access, you know, their full capacity to think. And I haven't seen any country that doesn't find the design side quite intuitive. You know, I've been in Japan, Singapore, India, all over Europe, and I think it's just an innate human thing to be able to be ingenious and to connect with other people and to create new things. So when it comes to traditional design, buildings and fashion and industrial design, there are some countries that are more sophisticated, more advanced, and more skillful than others. But when it comes to the mindsets and the principles behind design that can be applied in business, I think most countries around the world, you know, that most cultures can access that thinking, and that there's no bias one way or the other.
And finally, the word innovation keeps surfacing. Can there ever be a formula for innovation? And is that not the beauty of innovation?
Yes, to some extent. And there's no formula in this book either, by the way. That's really important. Some people think that it's a process that you have to strictly follow, and that's not the case. It's all about accessing fresh thinking. And that's what innovation is. Innovation, in its simplest form, is just trying to find new ways to create value and to do so in a way that you can sustain that over time. So innovation can be big, innovation can be small, but innovation is just new ways. And in order to come up with new ways, you need fresh thinking. In order to get fresh thinking, you need something that's going to stimulate that thinking. So that's really what this book is all about, is these are some of the tools that simply help teams think through wicked problems and access fresh thinking and come up with new solutions and new strategies to drive their business ahead. And I'm hoping that this will contribute to innovation, because there are too many people that say, oh, it's a mystery, some have it and some don't. And I don't think that's the case. I think everybody's got the potential to create new ways to create value.
That was our producer, Gillian DeBias, with Heather Fraser from Rotman's, author of Design Works, there. We'll be talking Danish design and business with young brand Architect Made after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Architect Made is a young Copenhagen-based brand who, in a short space of time, has made a very tidy business, bringing small products from Denmark's mid-century designers back into production. Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, met with Morten T. Jensen, the CEO, and Misha Juklova, the creative manager of Architect Made, to discuss their latest products and the state of Nordic design.
I started the company about 6 years ago. We started with one or two small products, and the whole philosophy is that we want to make a few good products. So we don't want to make a whole collection of new introduced things coming every year. It should be some things that last for a very long time.
And you are based in Copenhagen?
Copenhagen, yeah.
Great. And by products, you mean interior design?
Oh, yeah. Okay, start from there.
Furniture.
Yeah. It's a small accessories, you could say, like tableware, decorative items, and like trays and glasses and stuff like that.
Is everything made in Denmark?
Well, that's actually a really good question, because some of it is, and some of it we actually make in Beijing. Our most famous product, the bird, is made by a small wood turner in Denmark, and the rest of the stuff is made by small wood turners in Beijing.
Tell us more about the materials that you use.
We really enjoy working with wood. I think that would be our main area of expertise. Mm-hmm. So we do lots of teak wood, because that was what was popular in the 50s and the 60s. And we work with architects that did stuff from the 50s and 60s. But we also work with other kinds of wood. I mean,
yeah, all like sustainable materials, you could say, like steel, glass, stone, wood is primarily the materials.
And where do you source them usually? Where do you source your products from?
Well, most of the wood, for example, we have these iconic birds made of oak wood.
Yeah.
It's from Danish forest, for example. And depends on where the product is made. We try to source it as close to the production as possible. Quality is a main concern always. Sometimes we try to make a product and we have to make it perfect. So if we find out that suddenly it's made exactly like it should be, but it's just too expensive, then we just skip the project. So quality is a main concern. And there's very few people left in Denmark that can actually do this handcrafted work that we specialize in. So that's why we moved out sometimes.
Yeah, we're really, really big on craftsmanship and sort of upholding the key values and the key skills that come with that. So if, you know, if there's a skill that is in Denmark that we can teach to someone in China and we can uphold this kind of tradition, then that's what really gets us excited.
What is the status, the current status of Nordic design then and manufacturing and craft?
It depends. I think overall, unfortunately, it seems like it's dying out. There's, for example, we turn a lot of wood, and there's very few, like, professional wood turners left in Denmark these days. The one of them that are so busy making our products, so he couldn't take more products in, actually. And this is one of the main reasons why we tried to source it otherwise. For our concern is that we try to make it as perfect as possible and teach the new suppliers, the small wood shops, the quality and the standards that we expect in these like high-end design stores where we sell the products.
I mean, we prefer close collaboration with our retailers, so we would much prefer to go to a store, tell everybody the architect-made story, tell everyone the story of the bird, of the docks, of the glasses, and, you know, teach them the know-how. So rather than, you know, going to meet thousands of people at a fair, you know, we prefer a more personalized approach.
That's interesting. Can you describe your creative process? How do you turn an idea into a product?
When we get the idea for the product, we usually have an old drawing, actually, only like sometimes it can even be on a napkin, you can say. When we worked with Jan Utzon, for example, with these spring glasses, for example, it was just a little drawing on a napkin almost. And then we take it step by step from there together with the supplier to make it perfect, and then in cooperation with the family as well. For example, the son of Jan Utzon, who has helped us a lot, getting the product perfect as his father intended it should be, you know. So we have them to approve it in the end.
I think we also look for a quality of timelessness, because sometimes we don't get a napkin. Sometimes we get a vintage product that's been made before in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, they're not all the same. And if we can sometimes all agree on the office, this is exactly what, you know, was popular 50 years ago. It's what's popular now and what can be popular 50 years from now. So I think that's something that holds all of our products together.
This said, walk us through your best-selling products, besides the bird.
Well, I must say it is a lot of these wooden items, like the ducks and the new Oscar, the little dog by Hans Brüling as well.
It's beautiful.
And then the wooden trays, turning trays by Finn Yule as well, is actually very popular as well.
Yeah, I think so Finn Yule is actually sort of coming back now because it was his 100-year anniversary.
Yeah.
And he also recently won an award by Wallpaper for one of his sofas, so he's making a big comeback. I think that might be one of the reasons why the turning trays are so popular.
Absolutely. And finally, what's next for you guys? Any exciting upcoming projects?
We're actually focusing a lot on Finn Yule because his products are very timeless, and we have a few new products by him coming out actually next month and 2 months from now, hopefully before Christmas. A little wooden bowl that were exceptionally popular when he made it 50 years ago and sold very expensively on auctions as well today. That's one of them we're going to introduce again.
That was Nelly Gochiva with Morten T. Jensen and Misha Yuklova from Architect Made there. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be delving into the stands at the World Architecture Festival in Singapore. We'll be discussing what ugly means with Stephen Bailey, and we'll be finding out what a new 21st century souvenir for the city of Vienna might look like. So be sure to tune in then. This show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, we're staying in Denmark. This is the beautiful Agnes Obel, a former ballet dancer, would you believe? This is Avenue. Goodbye.